flying overweight, but not in the way you think. I'm Paul Plack, and this is Aero News. Welcome in to the Aero News special feature. Thanks for downloading us today. My guest is Bob Miller of Over the Airwaves, the journal for the proficient pilot. We're here to talk about safety issues today, and this one is entitled Flying Overweight, But Not What You Think. Bob, thanks for taking some time out to talk to our listeners today.
I'm glad you put it that way, Paul, because one could think that we're talking about a health issue here when, in fact, we're talking about something entirely different.
Well, no, I was intending to raise the specter that we might be talking about a baggage distribution. Well, maybe that's the same thing.
Oh, okay.
Why don't you tell us, Bob, exactly what your article was talking about? Because I think it's an interesting approach to explain the topic.
Well, you know, the topic leads into the discussion of stalls and stall speeds. And, you know, we try to instill in our students and all pilots that we work with the fact that the stall speed of an aircraft, you know, there are questions on the private pilot knowledge test that ask the student, you know, can a stall occur at any speed? And, of course, the answer is yes on the test. But it really misses the point, and that point is that stall speed, in fact, does increase as the weight of the aircraft increases. And we point out that the published stall speed for any aircraft is computed based upon gross takeoff weight at sea level. And then and they understand after a little bit of instruction that, you know, if we lighten the load of the airplane, half tanks and one passenger or no passengers, the stall speed is considerably less than that published in the pilot's operating handbook. And then I say, would you ever operate an aircraft over maximum gross weight? And they say, well, no, of course not, Bob. I would never do something like that. And then I playing along with my little scenario, say, well, you know, I do, and I do routinely. And they say, well, what are you talking about? And I'll say, oh, yeah, I says, it's nothing for me to operate an airplane several hundred pounds overweight. And the look of disbelief on their faces, you know, is kind of startling to watch. And then when I get to the point that I'll say that, you know, I've sometimes operated these Cessna Skyhawks at as much as 2,000 pounds overweight. And then they're scratching their head in total disbelief. And I said, you know, of course, if I operated that airplane 2,000 pounds overweight, what do you suppose the stall speed on the airplane would be? And they said, oh, mine, it might be considerably higher. Mm-hmm. And then again, I said, would you ever do that? And again, they say, no. And I said, well, I've asked them at that point, I say, you know, did you ever go fishing? And when you go fishing, how do you weigh a fish? And now they're not sure where I'm going with this example. And they say, well, you know, I put it on a fish scale. You know, I'll just hold the scale in one hand and hook the fish to the bottom of the scale. A little spring comes up and shows me the weight of the fish. And I said, that's fine. That's how I remember it. But I said, what would happen if you took that fish scale with an 8-pound bass on the end of it and started whirling it around your head? You know, and they said, oh, well, yeah, the fish would show much heavier weight. And, well, why would that be? And, of course, they explain centripetal force, you know, forces the fish outside the arc of the circle, and that increases the weight. And I said, does that give you any hint as to why I claim I operate airplanes overweight? And then that light bulb goes on. They said, well, sure, Bob, I guess in a bank. And from that, we're able to explain that in a banking turn, of course, the G-loading on an airplane increases significantly. And we go ahead to explain to them how to calculate what that increased G load would be and how that in turn affects the new stall speed. It's kind of an eye-opening explanation.
Well, and it's an interesting exercise to go through because, you know, obviously one of the things that gets people into this trouble, I think, one of the things that I have been tempted to do at times early in my flying was, you know, I'd be a little sloppy in the pattern or misestimate a crosswind and wind up having to bank tighter than expected to turn base to final. And unfortunately, there's a lot of people who don't live through that.
About 1 week. You know, that's the sad data. You know, we suffer one fatal stall spin accident a week in the United States, or about 50 a year. That's far too many to discount as just happenstance, you know, this is an acceptable loss rate. It's happening because people apparently are not understanding the effect of bank angle on stall speed. I've seen it myself in doing flight reviews, you know, asking students, what is the stall speed on this airplane as we go around base to final in a 50-degree bank? And they're telling, oh, Bob, it's 40 knots, you know, every day of the week. And we get on the ground and we walk through this exercise, and they have no idea that the stall speed increases exponentially as bank angle increases. It's a very, very steep curve. And I tried to point this out in Over the Airways by showing in that article, you know, the curve and how you compute load factor based upon bank angle, and from that how you can come up with a new stall speed. If everybody knew this and understood this, you know, our I suspect our fatal stall spin rate would go down dramatically. But even here, Paul, and I want to emphasize this, even here in the, you know, like Glenn Beck on CNN or Fox News with a chalkboard behind us, we can do all of this kind of explaining. But until the student understands it, or until the pilot understands it through actual experience, it won't have the learning effect that we want. And that's why I have long believed in going out and doing cross-controlled and accelerated stalls, so that pilots can see for themselves and watch an airplane go through a sudden stall at 65 or 70 knots when they expected it would do it only below 40 knots. That is an event they'll never forget.
Well, and it's kind of an important lesson, too, to back up something that I know a lot of flight instructors have as a normal course of events, and that is teaching students that, for example, they try to simplify it and say, well, you are not to get below 60 knots until you're established on final. Well, that's one way to avoid it, but I don't think there's any background understanding there for students to understand why they don't get below 60 knots unless you do something like this exercise you're talking about.
Yeah, I'm guilty of what you just said. I say no turns in the pattern under 70 knots. You know, I'll take control of the airplane if he makes a turn below 70 knots, and then we'll get on the ground and I'll ask him, you know, why 70 knots? And we'll pull out the graph and show them what the stall speed would be in an 80 degree bank. Well, Bob, I would never bank an airplane to 80 degrees. And I'll wager them they can and they will and they do. All I have to do is distract them in a turn at a safe altitude, and I can cause that airplane to go over not intentionally beyond 60 degrees of bank, which is a statutory limit, but inadvertently that go rolls beyond 60 degrees, 70 degrees, 80 degrees, and the student said, what happened? I said, you were distracted.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and from that, they're you know, trying to regain control of the airplane that is now in a deep stall and running very quickly towards a spin. And that, again, is and I'm not saying that inexperienced flight instructors should go out and do that sort of thing, and nor am I saying that I do that intentionally, but once we get an airplane over bank like that, man, it is an event that they'll never forget. And to do so would require, as we said in earlier conversations, those kinds of exercises must be done at a very safe altitude, you know, at least 4,000 to 5,000 feet in the air in case things get out of hand. So, you know, we're talking about learning here, and we're talking about learning theory. You know, it's one thing to read about it. It's one thing to explain it, but it's quite another to do it and actually experience it.
Well, and the load factor chart is a real revelation, too, because it shows that an 80-degree bank, were it to happen, would be a 6G load on the aircraft. That's assuming you're not falling sideways at 80 degrees. If you're actually to maintain level flight you'd have to do 6Gs. And that takes a 40-knot stall speed to 98 knots. So, I mean, that would really get your attention. Well, Bob, when we come back from the break, I want to talk a little bit about another article in the June edition of Over the Airwaves that you entitled Scatter the Flock. This is not about bird strikes. My guest is Bob Miller. We'll be back with more in a moment. I'm Paul Plack, and you're listening to a special feature from Aero News.
This is a story of two pilots. Our first guy, the one with Garmin Waas GPS, he just arrived home from a trip, ready to enjoy a nice home-cooked meal with his supermodel girlfriend.
Chérie, viens près de moi.
But our other guy, the pilot without Waas, well, he couldn't quite make it home. Had to divert to an airport with an ILS approach. So now it's dinner from a vending machine in some crummy pilot's lounge. You know which pilot you want to be. Garmin Waas GPS. Follow the leader.
Chérie.
At Cirrus Design, we don't ignore the fundamentals of aviation design. We just give them an ingenious new interpretation. The Cirrus SR20 G2. Interested in a substantial airplane that remains practical and affordable? Whether you're a non-pilot looking to begin flying lessons, a pilot needing personal transportation, or a fleet customer selecting the best plane to meet the demands of a multiple aircraft operation, consider the SR20 G2. To learn more, call 888-750-9927 or check us out on the web at cirrusdesign.com.
Welcome back to the Aero News Special Feature. Paul Plack here with Bob Miller of Over the Airwaves, the journal for the proficient pilot. And we're talking about something that happens in my experience a lot during the season of the year when we have a lot of cross-country flights being attempted for the first time. Sometimes it happens when we have pancake breakfasts going on, fly-in breakfasts. And Bob, you refer to it as scattering the flock. What are you referring to when you talk about this behavior by that name?
This is the inadvertent penetration of a traffic pattern while searching for an airport in unfamiliar territory. And we'll set up this scenario deliberately where we'll have a student, usually on the first dual cross-country flight, searching vainly to find an airport that's not easily identifiable. It might be, in our case, a grass strip as opposed to a big Class C airport, which you can't miss, you know, no matter how hard you try. But if you take a student, you say, all right, I want you to go to such and such a grass strip. It's on the sectional, and take me there, please. And what they do is they dutifully bring the airplane down to pattern, or what they believe to be a pattern altitude, as they approach an airport that they're not quite certain where is it located. And now they're down at pattern altitude, and they're stooging around, and all of a sudden they find the airport directly underneath them. And, of course, I'm out there with my eyes open, wide open, looking for traffic, making radio calls to ensure that the area, in fact, is clear. It's usually a nondescript private field, nobody around. But I said, if you did that, you know, at a fly-in breakfast where there are, you know, it could be 3, 4, 5 or more airplanes in the pattern, and you busted the pattern like that at pattern altitude, I mean, you're going to scatter the flock, you know, if not cause a tragedy to happen. And so there's a technique for doing or avoiding that kind of a scenario, and that technique is oh so simple. Whenever searching for an airport that you're not quite sure where it's located, be absolutely certain that you're flying at least 500 to 1,000 feet above the published traffic pattern altitude. Then when you inadvertently come upon it, perhaps directly over top of it, you're significantly above the traffic pattern so as not to cause a problem. Then the issue is, well, how then do I get into the pattern? Well, through a diagram I showed in the issue, in the Over the Airwaves issue, it's a very simple little maneuver. Just fly outbound in a prescribed heading for about 2 miles and then reverse course while descending so as to re-enter the traffic pattern precisely at traffic pattern altitude on the downwind leg, and you know exactly where you are at, and there's no risk posed. And so that's something that I think bears repeating to all of us. We all need to understand and recognize how easy it is to stumble upon an airport without seeing it until you're actually there.
I want to just add something to this that I've observed. I was flying one time at Aurora State Airport in Oregon, which I don't recall exactly. It's about 200 feet MSL at the airport. And a guy who was coming, trying to find the airport, found the airport. And apparently he was going to do a fairly steep descent because he reported that he was at 5,500 feet on the downwind. Now, to me, he's not on the downwind. I mean, you can't expect any of the protections you get or the safety benefits you get of following the rules of a traffic pattern when you're talking about basically diving down potentially on top of somebody who is at the proper altitude. So it takes both sides of that to work right.
Yeah, and how serious a problem is this? We know that more air traffic collisions occur in the non-tower controlled traffic pattern than any other airspace in the world. In fact, I remind my students when we go into a traffic pattern, I say, you're about to enter the busiest airspace in the world. And they say, what are you talking about? This is Wellsville. There's nobody down here. And I said, well, there very well could be, and in the traffic pattern is where we come very, very close to other airplanes. So here again, if we could all make proper traffic pattern entries at the proper altitude from the proper position with all of the appropriate radio calls, we could eliminate this. But time after time after time, when I do flight reviews with individuals, I see them coming in, or aircraft checkouts. You know, they arrive, you know, like your friend did, or the pilot that called in. You know, they're 1,000 or 2,000 feet above the pattern, and they're directly atop the airport, and all of a sudden they put the airplane in a left-hand dive and descend down into the downwind or base turn and said, well, there, I made the airport, didn't I? You know, and I'm breathing heavy at this point, saying, what in the world are you doing, friend? And where did you learn to do that? Well, you know. And so, whether it's our weakness as flight instructors not to properly instill this information at the onset, or that it's not being included in flight reviews as it should be, or we're just flat out forgetting it because we never understood the logic or the reason why we enter the pattern at the pattern altitude in the way we do. But again, that's reason for these kinds of writings that I do and the discussions that you and I do, that hopefully, you know, a little bit of relearning is good for the soul.
Well, it's good for my soul, Bob. I relearn a lot when we have these talks. And I thank you and look forward to talking to you again next Monday.
Thanks, Paul.
The June issue of Bob's monthly newsletter is now available at overtheairwaves.com. Also find a link there to Bob Miller Flight Training. You've been listening to a special feature from Aero News. Find us on the web at aero-news.net. I'm Paul Plack. Thanks for listening. Have a clear and unlimited day.